Welcome to the Power Play Podcast, where international cricketer Kyron Powell and marketing genius Jordan Shannon join forces, bringing you captivating conversations with the biggest players in cricket and business. Join us as we dive into the lives of current stars in the cricketing world, the legends before them, and those extraordinary icons whose performances changed the game in both cricket and business. Exploring journeys both on and off the pitch, the boardroom, and everything in between. Get ready for an exhilarating blend of cricket, life, and business insights with two insatiably passionate, infuriatingly no-holds-barred hosts, who, unfortunately for the rest of us, live and breathe this stuff for a living.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 28 of the Power Play Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Shannon. As always, I'm joined by Kyron Powell. And today we have a special guest in Philo Wallace. How are you, Philo?
I'm very well, Jordan. Nice to have me on your program.
No, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate it. So in terms of, obviously, we'll get going with this. How did you get into cricket and where did it all start?
Well, it all started for me in Barbados when I was a young man. I grew up in a village called Haynesville. Okay. And next door to Haynesville, there was another village called Hordersill. And Hordersill produced the Desmond Haynes, the Albert Padmores, the Claremore, the Beezers, the Franklin Stevensons. Then we had those who played for Barbados. It's like we had Ricky Skeet, Samuel Skeet, Ryan Hines, who went on to play for Barbados or West Indies, Adrian Griffith. So there were a whole host of guys who played cricket from that village of Hordersill. But I just used to walk through a small track, and I used to find myself playing cricket nearly every evening after school in Hordersill. Although I grew up in Haynesville. Haynesville was more soccer, but then Haynesville also had cricket. So then in the vacation times, you would get Hordersill versus Haynesville, and then we had Hoyts Village, where Courtney Brown came from, the former West Indies keeper and lead selector. So you have three villages, and then there was Hoyts Village. So you had all the H's playing against, so you had four H's playing against each other. And cricket just was it. You know, in those days, there was no cell phone or anything. It was just cricket and beach. That's what we used to play, cricket and go to the beach.
Sounds perfect to that, to be fair. So, growing up, who did you look up to from a cricketing perspective, and who was your idols?
Yeah, well, I used to look up to Desmond Haynes because he was the one who was at the forefront.
Yeah.
Desmond used to be, obviously, Barbados or West Indies player. He played in England. So every young cricketer wanted to be a Desmond Haynes.
Yeah.
And in those early days, he would come back into the village from his tours, and he would play cricket. Right. He would sit and talk with us. And you know, we talked to us about cricket, and then you obviously your minds will expand, and you said, I want to be like him. And then we had Franklin Stevenson, who never played for West Indies, but also was very successful as a first-class cricketer, and also around the counties and in South Africa. And he also used to lend a lot of advice to us as well.
Right.
So we had a number of former cricketers who would come in and we would play cricket on evenings. Sometimes on Sundays, we would play against the other villages. And these guys would actually play with you. So you get to learn, broaden your knowledge. And obviously, you wanted to be like them. I'm moving on from my village. Then I attended Ellerslie Secondary School, the same school as Otis Gibson. And we had a very good games master there by the name of Mr. Irvin Harris, who would have studied in England in the early days. So he studied in England, would have exposed him to cricket. Because when we went to Ellerslie, he then introduced us as young men at 11 years old to use Harrow size bats. Because when you go to a school, you take your own equipment, you feel like you're a man. But he introduced us to Harrow size bats to develop our stroke player, and also our wrists, to develop our wrists properly. Because if a young man uses a bat that is too heavy, he's not going to develop good wrist movement.
Right.
So these are little things that we learn as we grow up and had the right people around us to nurture us.
Yeah. So from high school, when did the opportunity, where was the next sort of stages in the cricket development?
Well, we went to Ellerslie Secondary School at 11 years old, and we played cricket at Ellerslie. We played house cricket, Blue House versus Red House. We played for the secondary school in intermediate cricket. As a young man at 12, 13, I played against big men.
Right.
Big Man. I played against Police, Pickwick Cricket Club. Those are clubs where men, and you're a schoolboy, you're playing among those guys and looking to compete. And then we played the under 15 competition in those days, which was the Ronald Tree.
Yeah.
Which is the under 15 competition in the summer, which ran for the whole summer, which is 8 weeks of cricket in the summer. And right. if you do well in that tournament, then you would start be thinking about this on the 19 team. And right, then we have combined schools, which is a school, the combined schools as its name, is a combination of all the secondary schools playing in the Division One cricket.
Right, okay.
So if you go to practice, and if you make the combined schools team, you're 1 foot into the under 19 team.
Right. So
if you make the combined schools team at 16 years old, you can assure yourself that you can make the Barbados under 19 team at 16 and play for at least 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, because once you get into that elite combined schools team, you're into Barbados team. And if you do well at the under 19 level, then you're looking at going into the senior trials.
Yeah.
So you might go into senior trials once you're good enough, 17, 18, you're at senior trials. And again, you rub shoulders with a Desmond Haynes. In my time, you have Malcolm Marshall. Gordon Greenidge was still playing. Carlisle Best, Ezra Mosley, all those guys were still playing cricket. So you were rub shoulders with those guys from an early age. So you get accustomed to playing hard, tough, solid cricket and playing against good cricketers.
So did you always, you know, at 12, 13, did you always see that path in terms of the route to get into it from, you know, turning, you know, sorry, go on.
Yeah, there was no other path.
Yeah.
And we went to a school, Ellerslie Secondary School, which cricket driven, because going into Ellerslie, then we learned that we had there were players like, as I said before, Carlisle Best, he would have played for West Indies on the 19th in that era. They had a guy called Henderson Roach, who would have played for Barbados on West Indies on the 19th. We had a Ronald Graham, a fast bowler. We had Peter Skeet. So we had all these cricketers coming through that system. We had Kyle Mayer's uncle, Aikens Clark. He was our captain. So you had all these senior guys helping you to develop as a young man. They saw the talent in you, and they continue to encourage you, because when you're playing for the school, all these guys are playing with you. Then when you go into Division One, these guys still come and support you because they're out of the school system now working. So you still find you had that learning curve going on for a very long time in your career. Because I made my first class debut for Barbados at 21.
Yeah.
And my first game, I scored 100. My first four-day game. Scored 135 at the recreation ground against a young Curtly Ambrose. Now Sir Vivian Richards was a captain at first slip. And you got no drives. Because if you got Curtly Ambrose and Kenny Benjamin, and Hamish Adney, in those days who were quick, and Sir Viv Richards at slip, you can't. There's no drives to you. And we had a young Elding back. You see, you had that kind of cricket.
Yeah.
So because of your grounding as a young man in Barbados, playing against tough opposition, getting into the first class cricket and playing against that quality attack, you said, look, I can do it, because you can rely on your experiences coming through as a young man.
Yeah. It was arguable, you know, you're arguably the hardest part of your career at that point, you know, with the no experience and the facing the attack that you had, you know, at 19.
Yeah.
It's arguably got, you know, it's giving you that massive grounding to go ahead and you know, really kick on.
Yes, it did. And the thing is that you always had a support system.
Yeah.
Even going into the village of Orderson, you had quality club cricketers.
Yeah.
Who would still be there to help you, although you were a first-class cricketer or representing Barbados at youth or senior team. You always had people in the village who would come and still work with you. You could still go into the village and practice with the local village team. They wouldn't say, don't come. They would encourage you to come.
Yeah.
And we had a mixture. We used to play hardball cricket, we used to play tape ball cricket, and we used to play softball cricket. And what we used to do with a tape ball is that we used to play tape ball in the roads, but they don't have as many cars now. We used to let half of the road, we used to get the length of the pitch, and let half of the road. And obviously, again, there are no drives. So it's strictly back for cricket. So you find that everybody want to be a fast bowler. So you develop certain batting skills. I mean, you take those skills from that tape ball into hard ball, it was normal. So a bouncer was a normal ball, but you get it in a hard ball game.
Yeah.
You know, you see other players flinching and you say, but that ball, you can knock that ball over there because you're accustomed.
Yeah.
So you got our development happened in the villages and in the schools. so that when we get on the playing fields, we had a good idea of what to do.
Sorry, John, not to cut you off, but Philip, do you think that the Caribbean, like, cricket has become too formal in terms of its development? Because, like, I also played, like, growing up, like, a lot of tape ball cricket, cricket on the beach and stuff. And I think that's one thing that helped me with being able to play fast bowling as well as I've been able to play fast bowling. But I think now when you look at West Indian batters, like, getting hit off, flinching from quick bowling, it's not something that you associate with the stereotypical West Indian batter. And I think, I mean, for me, like, you look at the pitches are so much slower. Nobody wants to bowl quick anymore. Everybody's talking about tough of off and stringing the ball. Last time I checked, the faster you bowl, a batter doesn't want to get hit or hurt. So he has to make a business decision now.
Yeah, I think that Kiran, you're one of the last Mohicans. Because you're one of the few opening batters in first class cricket who like fast bowling. And that is the joy to see. As a former opening batter, I like to hook and pull. Exactly. I hit your back over your head if you don't come in your right lengths. And these are techniques that you learn from playing the same softball and tape ball. You become fearless. Getting hit with a tape ball toughens you up. You go to the beach and you play beach cricket and you jump in the salt water, your skin gets tough. So when you go and face the red ball, you're not as afraid of them. We had guys like Patterson Thompson, he's now a pilot for Caribbean Airlines, used to bowl quick. We had Dame Maynard, Peter Thompson. We had quality fast bowlers, Vax Madras, Otis Gibson. We had quality fast bowlers, and we used to challenge them. So now the modern day batter, they're not challenged. I see them going to the nets and a man pelt a ball in something called a dog throw or something. And they don't really, and if you throw it too fast, they're scared. I see batters batting with rib guards. I mean, number from 1 to 6. I only saw a rib guard when I saw Malcolm Archer have one in his coffin in those early days. I never saw anybody use a rib guard because you could play that ball that coming. That was free runs. That was free runs to us. Now that is an old delivery. You know, yeah, because when you grow up, you can't bowl on a fella's foot. So if you're bowling his foot, you don't want to get hit with a tee ball, so you hit it with the bat. So when you put on pads and you get a ball coming down on your left side, you're looking to knock it away out the ground. I can remember when I was at Combine School's practice, it was the late Seymour Nurse. I was batting, and I thought I was batting well. He said, Wallace, take off the front pad. I said, well, coach, I only batted for a couple of balls. He said, but I never even started batting, you know. I just, you take off the front pad. So I go continue batting with one pad. He said, but it's on the right foot because you're pushing the left foot all the time. I get a hit on the pad. So the guys were still bowling fast, you know. So you know what you had to do now? Lead with a bat. So when the ball coming down on your foot, you got to hit it with a bat because you don't want to hit your foot. And these are things that develop you. And you obviously have to keep your eyes on the ball and make sure you present a full bat face. All those are things that we were taught. Now, the modern day cricketer is still like side of the ball and telling me he's not going to give himself room to hit the ball through the outside. In my era, we used to say that you're running.
Yeah.
Because we were coached, and Sir Garfield Sobers had done some work with me and stuff like that. We were coached to get behind the ball. When you access the ball, you get behind the ball, you can access it and hit it where you want to. If you stay like side of the ball is pitching off stump.
So, yeah.
I don't know how you can hit it. You can edge it. You might get away with a few shots, but you can't get away. But also, we learn basic techniques. So all basic techniques, we learn on the beach, you got to play back and across because the guys are not giving you a drive. Beach cricket is strictly short balls to pack and pull. And the balls are burned. So if a burned ball hit you, a man ball at 90 miles an hour, it get hit hard.
Yeah.
The first thing you do is run in the sea and clap that area because it stings. Things. That's how we were brought up. You take a lash, but as a batter who can bowl, you said to yourself, I want to bat for a very long time and score runs. Because the faster you come, the further you go.
Yeah.
I went on a tour to Pakistan at 22 years old. And now Richie Richardson told me he wants to burst the cricket ball. I say, you can cut it. He tell me, no, he's going to hit it hard because he doesn't bowl, so he can hit it hard and frighten the fielders in Pakistan. That's the kind of thing that you used to hear. Hit the ball hard. Hit it hard. If you hit the ball hard, you're frightening the fielders and the bowler, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's going to be a delivery that will come down that is going to be in your sweet area. And if you really strike it, you'll frighten even the spectators. So we used to play fearless cricket, but fearlessly, now there's a little apprehension to fast bowling from the West Indian batters, which is sad because there are certain things that can be done to make those modern day batters better. I talk about West Indies batters better to take on fast bowling. I'm used to playing Barbados something called Tip Me Two. You got to hit the ball and run.
Right.
You got to hit it and run. You can't, if you miss it, you miss it. But as you hit the ball, you must run. Don't matter where you get off strike. Those kind of things that develop your skills in relation to rotation of strike. I played 14 years of Barbados and Sherwin Campbell, who went to school with me at Ellison Secondary School. He was my opening partner from under 19 days straight up to senior team. Those are the kind of things that used to help Barbados cricket.
Yeah.
You had to be hunted in peers. I keep saying in every discussion I have with cricket, you hunt in peers, you hunt in bowling peers, you hunt in batting peers. West Indies success in the 80s and 90s, Greenwich and Haynes. Solid opening pair in the middle order, solidified, and fast bowlers and a good keeper. That's how we used to handle cricket. Now you're finding that we're putting people here and putting people there are really offsetting the whole equilibrium of cricket in the Caribbean. There's a lot of balance.
Yeah. In terms of like, you're saying there obviously about hitting the ball hard. Is that the grounding that you had and your sort of initiation into the professional sport? Is that where your aggressive nature came from in terms of, look, if you bowl in my half, I'm going to go after you?
Yeah, I went to Pakistan and I faced a guy called Imran Khan at Gaddafi Stadium. He bowled the first ball to me. I hit it over the ground for six. He asked me, where you come from? I said, they send me here to hit a red ball. And you bowl it in the area where you can hit it. So I knock it away. I went to Bangladesh and played a mini World Cup. And a guy called Javagal Srinath, who's now a match referee. The first ball, I hit him straight over his head for six. He said, but you haven't even let me settle. I said, that's a stupid ball. Because that is what batting is about. If you're a batter, there's certain things that you must do.
Yeah.
And you must make a statement as a batter. You must go and you make a statement. I'm not saying slog. But if you're confident enough to hit the first ball for four and it comes down in that area where you can play that shot to hit it for four, play it. We had the late Sir Conrad Hunt who hit the first or the last ball of an innings for four. Because that's how we played our cricket. We played our cricket in a way where people would be thrilled and stunned to see the type of cricket that we used to play. Now we're playing a brand of cricket that we're trying to fit into everybody's pocket. I don't think that is right for West Indies cricket. We have to go back to all years of playing cricket, which is dynamic, with a smile on our face, but being disruptive. That's what I feel. We play cricket a little too friendly in the West Indies.
Well, yeah. How would you go about bringing that back into it then? So if we talk about this. Down the line in this conversation, we're going to talk about the T20 World Cup that's around the corner. So this now starts next month. Next month.
Yeah.
How do you go? How do you get that into that side now?
It is about you have to. They're in a camp at the moment in Antigua.
Yeah.
And you have some of the greatest cricketers that ever played for West Indies in Antigua.
Mm.
You have Sir Vivian Richards. Sir Richard Richardson is a match referee, so I don't know how much he can do, because as a match referee with ICC and he goes around and talks to West Indies cricketers, you know how people will view that.
Yeah.
You've got Sir Andy Roberts, you got Winston and Kenny Benjamin. You got a lot of former West Indian cricketers in Antigua who played that brand of cricket. You have Ridley Jacobs, one of our most successful wicketkeeper batters. You have him there. So you can use those fellas in that camp. You don't have to bring them every day. You have a different day set up for somebody to just come and impart knowledge. Or have an evening with them, a sit-down evening, and a discussion about cricket. And then and one thing I can tell you is that I remember I went to Australia. When I came back, I asked Everton Weeks, the late Everton Weeks, to have a look at me. And we were practicing at Kensington Oval. So 2 weeks passed, and I didn't hear a word from Sir Everton. So I picked up the phone and I called him. I said, Sir Everton, I asked you to come and have a look. He said, I've been watching you for 2 weeks, and you stopped hitting the cricket ball. So if you get the grace to come and talk to those guys, they don't have to come and physically, you don't have to see them watching you practice, They can watch you from a distance.
Yeah.
And say, look, because, if Sir Vivian Richards talks to you tonight and come and watch you practice tomorrow, you're going to be different. You want to impress Sir Vivian Richards. But he wants to see you in your natural and relaxed element. So they Everton watched me from a distance. So the guys can watch them from a distance and then say, look, I think you've changed your transition, the general of your game. Why don't you go back to what you naturally know? And I think that is how we can inculcate that aggressive yet nice cricketing culture back into our cricket. I know the T20 World Cup is just around the corner and they can do it. It just calls for better planning and get the players who are in that camp to buy in to what is being sold to them by the former greats. There's a win-win situation.
I think in general, though, Phil, like the mentorship, and you see as you stress on even from your age group years coming up to your senior years, and even I guess when you're a senior player playing for West Indies, Barbados, you talk about sort of that mentorship, that you know, that whole community effort where it's not even just the international players, but you have like the solid seasoned club cricketers in Barbados, etc., that would be able to have a look at you, continually talk to you, etc. I think that's missing in West Indies cricket now, because, like, for example, you finish a game now, everybody jumps on their phone, everybody wants to get in the bus as quickly as possible. Nobody wants to sit down and talk about cricket. You know, so it's baffling to me, because when I came into cricket, like, same thing with you. Like, I started playing like senior club cricket at like 12 years old. So I was always around big men playing. And I was like, my father clearly doesn't love me, because he hasn't been playing against big men bowling 80 something miles an hour as a 12 year old. But it's just natural progression for you. You're ahead of your age group and trying to obviously try and challenge you. And then you listen to the conversations. And so you learn cricket that way and you can incorporate certain things into your game. But I think, like, even with the former greats and stuff, I think West Indies cricket needs to use them a lot better, because I keep saying, like, once they die, we can't get this information back, you know, and nobody's coming to be a great savior, you know. Yeah. So if it's a situation where you get, for example, the greats, you say to them, look, we have XYZ as a budget, because you can't expect people to do things for free. Like, you have to pay these people for their time. So you tell them, look, we have a budget. I need you, Mr. Viv Richards, to come and talk to the Leeward Islands franchise maybe once or twice a year, to the West Indies team once or twice, because they have so many greats throughout the Caribbean. And it doesn't have to be just them talking to their local players. It could be like you put on camps, like, why don't you have an opening batters camp at the end of every season, so that whether it be white ball cricket, red ball cricket, you could spend a 2 weeks or a week with a Desmond Haynes and a Gordon Greenidge going through the art, the intricacies of opening the bat, and the same thing with fast bowlers, you know, so many different people that we could use, because then that's valuable information that could help these players to progress faster as well.
I agree. I have a lot of Barbados too, Kieran, is that I play for a club called Spartan. The great Sir Clive Walker played for that club. Former West Indies president, West Indies wicketkeeper, batter, ICC, the first black ICC president. And that club is rich in history. We had guys like George Linton, we had Roy Allen, we had Tony Howard, the late David Holford, and David Murray. We had Livingston Packrin, a former Barbados youth team captain, a successful club captain, player for Barbados. We had a host, we had the late Mark Levine, Henderson Springer, D.F. Marshall, the list goes on, Bennett, Solomon, Ben. So we always had a history of cricketers around us. You know, you had guys like Arlington Hunt, a very dominant left-hand spinner, never played a few games at Barbados, but very good at club level. So we had those guys in our clubs as well, who help us to develop our skills and get our mindset on where you can go with cricket. And when I played, it was only 50 over cricket, 3-day cricket and 4-day cricket, and obviously the elevation to test match cricket, which was only test match cricket or 50 over cricket. There wasn't no T20 stuff. So you had to hone your skills in order to get where you want to go. And the thing is that performances used to count.
Yeah.
Because I went to the West Indies 18 tour to Sri Lanka, and Stuart Williams and Riley Jiggers and myself scored lots of runs. And we were selected for West Indies. So performances, you go to those tours and you make them count. And these are the things that I don't see the young cricketers doing. They go on tours and they get a little 40 and a little 50 and they say, yes, I've arrived. It doesn't work that way.
No.
You have to show consistency and work hard at your game. When I was playing consistently for Barbados or West Indies, I used to run at midday. because you play first class cricket at 10 o'clock and it finishes at 5 in the Caribbean. But the hottest part of the day is between after lunch and eight. So if you don't acclimatize yourself to the heat, you're going to struggle.
Yeah.
So you train hard when it is hot, so that when you're actually in the game, you're cruising because you're accustomed. And these are the kind of things that all players need to do. And we were never unfit. Nobody had to tell us to run 1,000 miles. It was prepare yourself to play cricket because cricket was physical.
Yeah.
It was serious. You had to be on your P's and Q's with cricket. There was no time to relax. If you're not running on the road, you're in the beach or you're beach training. Even learning to dive, I learned to dive by going on the beach. Somebody throw the ball and you dive and catch it entering the water. There was no mat you can dive to on your left and stuff like that. So you had to develop the skills.
Yeah.
And your mind is a key. Once you dive and catch that ball and it land in water, you go on a cricket field and you see the ball in the air and you can dive and catch it to your left or right, you're going to do it.
Yeah.
Before fear. So I think that our cricketers have become very timid. They're half-hearted in how they approach things. Even our fast bowlers are timid. If I bowl that guy a fast, I've bowled, so he might come and bowl me one. So what? I played a game, my first class game in Antigua, and Gordon Grinnis get hit in his face between the grill, and he was driving one of Viv's vehicles, and he told Sir Vivian Richards, well, Viv Richards, he said, "Go, leave me alone," and I said, "But you're driving a man's vehicle." He said, "Well, he could take it back. He only wants me to get out." So I said, and I jumped. I said, "But you're in Antigua, you're using your friend's vehicle, you get hit in your face, and you're telling him, no, I don't want your help. Because he's going to go up there, mushy-mushy, next ball, he might get out, and that's what Viv wanted." And that taught me something, that when you're representing your country, although it's a friend is there in the back, there's a friend is on the other side, it is what you're supposed to do for your country. Country first. Performances matter, not you being a friend with somebody on the opposite side. Then the cricket is finished, then that friendship will rekindle. But on the field, it's me against you. And I think we've lost that kind of attitude, that rivalry, but still friendly. We've lost it. And that is something that we need to rekindle in our cricket.
When do you think that it was starting? When do you think you lost it? When do you think it started to decline?
I think the decline of West Indies cricket has been for a long time. We didn't have a succession plan. I played in 1990. I went to Pakistan in 1991, the winter of 91, then to World Series in Australia from then 92. And you started to see the decline. Richie was captain, and you started to see decline. But obviously, everybody thought that when you're big and tall, you'll be a fast bowler.
Yeah.
And then we started to produce big and tall spinners. So yeah, the decline was there, but we never really had the mechanisms in place to help define the cricketer, to work him into what we want him to be in those early days. So we've lost it. We've lost it. The whole pathway to sustainability, the sustainable performances, the sustainable aggressive cricket. We've lost it, and then we had to reincorporate other techniques into our cricket that made us a little timid. And then because ICC came in with a rule where we had one bouncer put over, something like that.
Yeah.
We used that as a hindrance. Whereas in helping our fast bowlers to develop better skills. And then we saw it.
And obviously the introduction to the one shot, one bouncer and over, having an impact. What would you say about that?
Yeah, that one bouncer per rule impacted our fast bowlers to be effective. But we didn't develop other skills.
Right.
To incorporate our bouncer rule, because we thought that because we can bowl 3 or 4 bouncers, we can get a batter out. And I thought that we should have had a bit more thinking and strategic planning and just working, get our bowlers to work out batters in those eras rather than just relying on the short ball. The short ball then would have to be a surprise ball, and then you have to hone the skills on bowling at a decent line, a decent length, at good pace.
Yeah.
Because then when that one bouncer rule came in, we saw a lot of people looking to swing the ball. And we were always, and we heard the coaches would say to the fast bowlers, "Well, cut your pace down and swing the ball." And I used to say, "But why swing the ball slowly? It's best to swing the ball fast." Malcolm Marshall, Ian Bishop, they used to swing the ball fast.
Yeah.
So if you swing the ball fast, it is just effectively bowling three short balls. And then the Pakistanis came on board with reverse swing. They never reverse swing the ball slowly.
Yep.
They reverse swing the ball quick.
Yeah.
So we use that one bouncer rule to slow us down in relation to fast bowling, to slow us down, and we started a bowl 9-11 swing. So the slower you bowl and you swing the ball, the less effective you will become.
Yeah.
So we did not use that passage of play in the correct way, and we find ourselves lagging, and then our pitches start to deteriorate in the Caribbean.
Right.
Because when I first played in first class cricket in Barbados, you play Kensington over, you get a quick pitch. You go to Jamaica, hard play, you get a quick pitch. You have Alison Thompson and Courtney Wall. So no pitch is slow in Jamaica. Franklin Rose, Joseph Grant. You go to Trinidad, you had Ian Bishop, Tony Gray. The ball would seem a bit at Queen's Park, and then it would flatten out on you. But it would always seem in Queen's Park, and Bishop and Gray would bowl fast. You go to Ghana, you knew you could get a docile pitch. So there's certain chops you had to, you could not play in Ghana, you could not cut and pull. So you look to push the ball down the ground a lot. You look to push at the ball in Ghana rather than hit at the ball. If you hit at the ball at a slower pitch, you can either hit the ball to mid off and get caught or extra cover or even drag on. I mean, you're going to the islands, you know that you're going to find slow pitches. So you had to adapt.
Yeah.
All the pitches played differently. Now in the region, all the pitches played the same.
Yeah.
So when you go on tour now as a West Indies team, and you get a pitch that is bouncing or seeming, you're like a cockroach in milk. So the thing is that because of the docile pitches in the region, the batters don't adapt to the different conditions, and that is where we are falling down.
I was actually talking to one of the head groundsmen in Trinidad recently during the past few matches, and he was saying something to me that I found interesting, because I know growing up, again, like when they build pitches in the Caribbean, like you'll dig however deep they'll dig, and they put in the stones and the sand, and then before they put the clay and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But he's saying no, all the pitches have become the same sort of profile because they don't do that anymore, which they sort of relayed all the pitches for the World Cup in 2008, but they went by some theory, I guess maybe the ICC had provided them with. But I think what they seemingly forgot is that each island is different, and building pitches outside of the Caribbean is completely different to building pitches in the Caribbean. So I think if we can go back to, you know, obviously having those big stones at the base of our pitches with the sand and the clay and stuff, that will bring back a lot of, I guess, the life in the pitches, and stop using these heavy road rollers as well. I'm not a big fan of that. That's laziness. Like, get people to pull the rollers.
Yeah, but my thing is that, my little knowledge of preparing a pitch is that in order for a pitch to be fast, the pitch must have body. It has to be hard underneath. And the only way it can get hard underneath is if you wet the surface and roll it. I know they have these rollers now, these drive mode things that they pull over the, like a mini rocking engine that they roll the rolls with, a roll or whatever, the auto roller, what you call them. But I know in the early days, in order for the pitch to be hard, you have to bind it and get it compact. And you used to see it look like mud. And you will pull that roller, and then you will let it settle, and then you will spring them again, and you will roll, and it will start to shine. And then you will see the groundsman spinning in the roller on the pitch to get it to shine and get it to bind harder. Yeah. You would just take a ball and bounce it, and the ball will fly out. So compaction is the key. And then if you have live grass, you roll that live grass into the pitch. But now they will roll the live grass in, and then they will take a weed whacker and whack it off.
And cut it off.
So then you cut off the live grass, and you have dead grass. So the ball will not, if the ball hits dead grass, it is dry grass, it will bounce. But if the ball hits live grass, which is wet, the ball with skin. All these are little things that I don't know where the curators, they have curators camps, ICC comes down, and they do this, they do their thing. But we as laymen, we don't know what they do.
Yeah.
What they're told. And we have a T20 World Cup starting in a few weeks, and the surfaces in the region have been relayed. The USA have brought in drop-in pitches. So it's going to be a good, it's going to be nice to compare the drop-in pitches in the USA, how they play, to the relayed surfaces in the region.
Mm.
And I think that anybody who is astute do that comparison from early to see how the drop-in pitches perform and the scores on the drop-in pitches compared to the pitches, to the scores on the pitches that have been relayed in the Caribbean. Because obviously the Caribbean cannot afford a drop-in pitch. So they've decided to dig them up and relay them. I hope they relay them the old-fashioned way. But we have to wait and see the scores and how they play. But we don't know how they will play yet. So that is going to be interesting. The T20 World Cup in the Caribbean, the USA, those pitches to me are going to be key. Because if you look at the IPL, we are seeing totals in excess of 250.
Yeah.
And our heads are hurting. And the bowlers are struggling. And the T20 World Cup is on the horizon. So all those connotations makes for interesting viewing when it actually starts.
That's actually a conversation Jordan and I had on, because it's interesting that, you know, all these new pitches with not much game time, so nobody knows what's a good score, if it's better to bat first, bat second. But one thing I do know for sure is that playing cricket in the Caribbean, if they relay the pitches the same way, there is no 250 happening on the smallest ground in the Caribbean. The pitches in the Caribbean and the way that they prepare them, teams are going to be in for a rude shot, especially those teams coming from the USA to play games in the Caribbean, because the outfields in the Caribbean are obviously a lot heavier than most places around the world. And then depending on what time of the day the game starts in the Caribbean, so the pitch is going to be a bit tacky as well if you're batting first. So that these are things that they have to factor in terms of how teams want to play.
Yeah, my biggest fear too, Kieran, you hit it on the nail on the head, is the pitches are relayed, but a lot of matches will be played on them. And you know that when you relay a pitch and it's not bind properly, it's going to move.
Yeah,
it's going to feel like it's moving. So these are things that have to take into consideration. How well are those pitches are going to be paired that they can say, look, you can play on this pitch and don't have any fear. And these are areas that are unknown to us. Maybe some of the curators as well, they'll be hoping that they can really do their best to get a pitch out that is satisfactory to the T20 standards that are set around the world. And obviously, you're looking at a pitch. I believe the pitch is the Caribbean to be balanced, where a bowler can put in something and get something out, and a batter can bat and play proper shots and score runs. I think if the T20 game is too one-sided, it just becomes a baseball game to me. You just stand up and swing. You still like to see a little balance in T20 cricket. And I hope that the surfaces can produce that balance and good cricket. Because an opening batter don't mind going to a T20 game and the first three overs is a little movement. Once he can sit down on that movement and get into it when it flattens out, then he can express himself. Yeah. That's the quality of an opening batter to me. And a good opening bowler will realize there's something there and he can zone in on his areas. And a good batter can sit down and wait, rotate the ball and wait for a bad ball. And then when the pitch flattens, then he can express himself. That's why we like to see. But we have to wait until June 1st. The first game is in America, and that's a drop-in pitch. Then the second is in Guyana on a relayed surface.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it might be a lot of 150s versus 140s and stuff, but we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, and people believe that the grounds in the Caribbean are small, so they expect big totals. But Kieran can tell you that sometimes you go to a club ground and it's small, and you can only get 110.
Yeah.
And the team that chases sometimes get bowled for 80. So they're looking for big totals on small grounds, but it can reverse. Sometimes you get small totals that are difficult to get.
Yeah.
I've seen guys get caught more on small grounds than on big grounds.
They miss it a lot of balls on small grounds. Yeah. You know, yeah. So that is the key. So the T20 World Cup, because they say the Caribbean grounds are small, that don't mean the totals are going to be big.
Yeah.
You know, bowlers can lift the game on small grounds too, huh?
But surely this has got to be an advantage, though, for the West Indies. Surely.
Yes, I think it's an advantage to the West Indies. An advantage because they know the conditions.
Yeah.
The coach, Dan Sammy, obviously, he has laid out his plans for what he wants. There's a style and a brand of cricket that he's expecting his charges to execute. Also, Captain Power will have to be part of that planning. He's looking at giving various players roles. But I hope that they understand their roles and don't take the roles to dinner. Because in order for a plan to be executed, the individual players need to understand this is what I have to do.
Yeah.
I need to do it more often than not, because consistency is going to be the key to get into the Super 8s. Because West Indies should be looking at getting into the Super 8s, because they're in Zone C with Namibia, and they got New Zealand, Afghanistan, and I can't remember the other team. So to be just the first two games are going to be in Ghana. They need to win those first two games convincingly against those lesser sides, although all sides are equal because in the World Cup. And then when they go over to Trinidad and St. Lucia, they need to hold their own in those two games against New Zealand and Afghanistan. And they can only play, they will only get confidence going in against Afghanistan and New Zealand once they can come out of Ghana with 4 points with those two wins.
Yeah.
But Afghanistan is not going to be an easy walkover. No. Rashid Khan and those guys know how to win. They've been around the world now, playing a lot of T20 cricket successfully, and they can win. And you will see that when these guys turn up for their countries, they're different. They're different beasts.
Yeah.
They really put in the stock to their country. So it is not as easy as people think it is. West Indies will have to play out of their skins from game one.
Yeah.
Get into the Super 8s because, again, they're playing at home. And everybody wants to beat the team that is playing at home. So we need to be consistent from that first game in order to set a pattern. There's a series against South Africa as well, three games up in Jamaica.
Yeah. Yeah.
Clay surfaces, they're going to be on clay surfaces, different to what they have in Guyana. So that is another connotation.
Yeah.
And most of the guys who have been in the World Cup will be playing in those three T20s. So that's also going to be a benchmark as well for West Indies, to see how good they perform on the surface that is true. And I believe the minor part would be true. And then to move down to Guyana, to play on a surface that you know sometimes is low and slow. So the adjustment and the adaptability of the players are going to be crucial. And that is why I agree with Kieran that mentoring factor with some of our former greats should come into play.
Yeah.
Because they need to adjust, because a lot of first-class cricket don't play in Ghana like before. The only cricket that plays in Ghana will be the CPL, because our first-class cricket this year was concentrated in Jamaica, St. Kitts,
and Trinidad,
and Antigua. We didn't get to Guyana. So Adnan was playing at Barbados. So these are the things that I have to weigh up. So you could go down to Ghana, and you're looking for a flat ball, and you get one at Bunton. So but West Indies have a good chance. I think the squad is a good squad. I was surprised at certain selectors, but they're there and you support them. But they need to come with their A game for that World Cup, and they need to start from that South African series, win that series, give themselves confidence and supporters' confidence to come out and support them.
Yeah.
That is important. The support will come from West Indies once they start to do well. When they're doing well, the people will come out and sing and dance. And they will put fear in the opposition, because you see a lot of people supporting West Indies cricket, but they have to do well and they can't shy away from being aggressive, but be nice.
Can I ask you who was some of the shock selections then in the 15? Who you thought was some of the shock selections?
I thought that Hetmyr was lucky, because I'm judging from what was said before that they have a set group of players for the last 2 years playing together.
Yeah.
I thought that they misused and mismanaged Kyle Mears, because I think Kyle Mears could be more effective for us if he was given more bowling and maybe slot down in the middle rather than being at the top looking the talent everything. I thought that was a detrimental, because he's a good striker of the cricket ball, and as Kieran would tell you, opening batter who challenges the new ball more often than not will not succeed. So you can't challenge a new ball like how he challenged a new ball in the T20 game and be successful. You're going to fail more often than not. And that is where the inexperience came in. I thought we would have established an opening pair, build around that opening pair. I have Kyle Mears in the middle to add muscle, because he can bat spin. And once the ball is not bounced by his head too often, he can knock it away. And plus, he's a decent medium pace bowler. He swings the ball and he can feel. Hetmyr is one-dimensional. I don't ever want to go into his fitness, because as a professional cricketer, he should be fit. So he has been indisciplined as a professional cricketer, Hetmyr, and I've lost a lot of confidence in him, because from being on the 19th World Cup in 2016, Hetmyr should have been telling himself he wants to lead West Indies team in another 6 or 7 years. And he was good enough to play all three formats. But you allow other things to come into your player, other thoughts and people to get into your head. And now you find yourself playing T20 in the IPL. And now you're not even playing. He's carrying drinks.
Mm.
So these are things that, that sometimes you look at players and say, but you should have done better with your management of yourself, or players lack management. So from that 15, I would have stopped with Kyle Mears. I would have allowed him to bat in the middle and bowl. Because we only picked two openers in Dawson Charles and Brandon King. And Brandon King is coming off an injury, and nobody knows what injury he had. He didn't go to Nepal. He missed that tour to Nepal at 18 tour. But he's in the camp in Antigua. But we don't know what injury Brandon King suffered in the first class cricket. How much cricket he has played, I don't think he's played any since that injury. He's just in training. Yeah. So he will be picked against South Africa, and he will have to go up to his hometown, Jamaica, and look to do well. But again, being in Jamaica at Sabina Park on a hard clay surface, he can hit through the line of the ball and score. Now that first game for West Indies on June 2nd in the ICC T20 World Cup is going to be in Ghana.
Yeah.
On a surface that wouldn't be as true as Sabina Park.
Yeah.
And you would expect that all the teams in the T20 World Cup will feel properly. So if you get a chance early, you're out.
Yeah.
And you know how T20 cricket is. If you don't start well, it affects you all the time.
Yeah.
It's not like a 50-over where you can say, I can come in the next game and bat the first 10 overs and look for a score. You've got to hit the ground running in the T20 cricket. So that's what I'm saying. The opening pier is key to every West Indies get those totals in excess of 180. The opening pier must bat deep into the overs and be effective to leave the latter overs for the muscles, for the Purans, for the Powells and the Russells to come in there and muscle the ball around. But if those guys come in too early, we can smell trouble. So it is important that our opening pier solidify the top by scoring runs consistently, giving us that foundation, as they say, in which we can launch. Because we have the power, but if you have no launching pad, that is just power. So it is key. It is key. They have a good chance, but they need to plan properly because all the teams will be coming gunning for West Indies. And another big thing too is that we've won it twice. And we're looking to do it a third time in the Caribbean. Added pressure.
Yeah. Well, it'll be the first team to win the trophy on the home soil, won't it?
Mm. Yep, there will be.
Mm.
Who else has some other like surprising selections for you, Villa?
Well, we've gone in with two left arm spinners. Well, Akil Hussain and Kuzesh Moti. Moti didn't have a good outing in Nepal against I don't want to underestimate Nepal. You expect Moti to move well in Nepal. In conditions, I believe, that were a favorite spin. So I don't know if he's gone off the boil a bit. Sometimes you can go down on confidence.
Yeah.
But you're playing two left-hand spinners. You still have Ross and Tears as your spinner. I would have preferred maybe to see a leg spinner. I like Hayden Walsh Jr. I think that he brings the X factor. But because the captains in the region don't understand leg spinners.
They use leg spin, yeah.
They don't know how to handle the young man. And he struggles when he plays in the region. Because Hayden Walsh Jr. to me is a match winner. And the key about him, he can hit a six.
And he was joint leading wicket taking the Super 50 just concluded as well.
So even in Nepal, he wasn't handled properly. So all leaders, our captains don't know how to handle that young man. And they hurt him more often than not. Because he can feel, he can bowl, and he's electric in the field. He brings energy. And that is what you need. But we've gone with two left-hand spinners, and one is struggling. And we don't know how Akil Hussain is going, because he's not in the IPL. But we saw Moti in Nepal, and I thought Moti was down on confidence. So it's going to be very interesting to see how they balance that. And the first game is in Guyana.
So all three will play.
So you've got to play. Chase will be the off-spinner who can bat. And we underestimate Akil Hussain as well with the bat. Yeah. I can't and to leave Moti in Guyana, that'd be a capital B, a big call. So I don't know how they can do it. Selectors will have their headaches. But the first two games are in Guyana on a pitch that will favor slow bowling.
What are your thoughts on Shamar Joseph and Jason Holder's selection?
I think Jason would always come in to play Kieran. A lot of people believe that he has not lived up to his expectations and he's coming back a bit on his cricket. I think that Jason needs to play cricket. This thing about managing workload and I can't understand that. But you watch me for Gloucestershire for about 19 years. I miss about 5 games. So I think the more cricket they play, the better you become and the stronger you become. You get to understand your body. I think all players don't play enough cricket to understand their body. So they don't push the extra mile. And Jason is one. Jason don't push the extra mile. He played he plays against Vusik. He got 100. But in the wickets column is not what we expected. But he got a first-class 100. So with his bowling, we expect more of him, but he's now coming into the twilight. So that wicket column, I believe, will continue to be the same. So we have to utilize Jason Holder now as a batting all-rounder rather than a bowling all-rounder. Because he's tall, he has the reach, he now has the ability to knock the ball away. So again, it's how we manage him in the T20 World Cup and what is his role in the World Cup. Because so he has to be managed well and he has to understand what he's supposed to do and do it more often than not. Shamar Joseph, I like Shamar Joseph because he's the X factor. He didn't get a lot of games at the IPL, but he's done something in Australia that's making up the world. Fast bowling at good pace on good lines and good lengths. You can beat people and you can beat good batters in Australia. Yes, it was in Australia with a pink ball, and it was fast bowling. And I believe that if you can bowl fast with a pink ball and get wickets, all it means is that you're making the adjustment with a white ball in T20 cricket. Because you can bowl fast and be successful. I'm not being fooled by the IPL or what I'm saying with all those runs. I believe that if you bowl decent pace and get the ball to do something, you will get wickets. And we don't have wicket takers, fast bowlers that take wickets in the Caribbean. What he has done is in Australia. But again, it's when he comes back to the region, getting into that squad, and what the head coach expects him to do. What are the areas he's looking at? And he has to target areas in which he has to hit his lengths hard. Because if you go into T20 cricket and you bowl like deliveries, you can get hit far, and that is going to make your confidence. So I think that he needs to understand you're a fast bowler, and you need to bowl fast on a certain level. And the ball that a lot of them forget is the Yorker. I believe if you go up in there with a good Yorker, no batter can hit you for 6, unless it's a Vivian Richards, and he stopped playing years ago. So he has to be focused and disciplined. If he does start in the T20 World Cup, he has to hit his lines and lengths hard and force batsmen to rethink, looking to back away and slow. So he can be an asset, but it's how he prepares himself and what the coach and captain expects him to do it, and he has to do it. So I think the selection of Joseph is a good one, but it's how he is managed and brought into that T20 setup for West Indies to be successful. My other fear is Alzarri Joseph. We've given him the T20 captaincy, which I think is a mistake, because as you see from the IPL, he's not playing often. And that can wrench your confidence. And he is a confidence bowler. And we want him to be as comfortable as possible going into the T20 World Cup. Because I find that with Alzarri Joseph, when he's in an environment that he likes and is comfortable with, he does well. He just captained the Leeward Islands in Super 50 cricket and done wonderfully well because he was in an environment that he liked and he understood what he had to do. Although he was leader, but he has done it. And this is where management comes in. So somebody from West Indies, Cricket West Indies, should be asking the management side or even the players from that Leeward Island side, what did he do that he was so successful? And then you take that information, and when he comes into that T20 unit, it's the same information you're feeding to him. What you have done in the Super 50 with that attitude, we want you to bring it to our T20 cricket. That is all it is, you know. It's no rocket science. It is just communication and managing and understanding players. Because if Alzarri is bowling well, and you know how it works, Alzarri bowls well, Russell will continue, I believe he will continue to bowl well because he's fitter and stronger. You get Jason and whoever. The bowlers will come together as a unit and mesh, and they'll bowl and support each other. Then the batters will come together and get consistent performances. You have a unit. That's how you build it.
You're saying there about...
I don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Pardon? Sorry, you're saying there about communication and obviously the Jason Holder point. What I feel that potentially it hasn't taken place is the communication that he was probably part of the T20 plans. Because if he's come over here, I totally agree what you're saying there. To come over here and play cricket, more cricket is good cricket. But he must have had an eye on the test team rather than getting called up to the T20 squad.
But he was in Australia with a T20 squad.
Yeah, okay.
But you want me to tell you the interesting thing about this fellow? Like, Jason missed the Australia test series to say that he was focusing on his preparation for the T20 World Cup.
Yes.
Which now you would think that he should be playing IPL or like just practicing, but he was over here saying that he's preparing or trying to put his name in the hat for the test team. So like it didn't really make sense or match up like his decisions over the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, his from what he was saying, he was confused. Because you missed a whole test series to work on white ball skills at Rajasthan Royals in India, and who did not retain you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Here, Obey McCoy. They didn't retain, both of them were released. So you went to this franchise high performance to improve your white ball skills, and they didn't retain you for the IPL. You came to the Caribbean. You went and jolly round the world and played some T20 cricket. Then you came to the Caribbean. You played 4-day cricket for Barbados. You scored 100. You get some wickets. And then what's the calls that say, can you play 5 games for us? And you say, yes, I can play. And I want to prepare myself for a test series.
Yeah.
But yet you were honing your skills late last year for white ball. Now you're in the World Cup. So he's leaving England to go into Antigua to prepare now for T20 cricket. And the beauty of it is that he's been playing red ball cricket. So he's been developing and working on his skills. He has to take now the skill sets that he has learned from Worcester and that 100 he scored against Kent batting. He has to now put all of that into a package and make it a complete T20 package because he's already got the basics covered for the longer format. So we now have to see how Jason Holder will perform in the T20 World Cup after coming out from England playing 4-day cricket. Because if he goes into that T20 World Cup and does well, that means the value of 4-day cricket is there. And that is what Jason Holder has to be thinking.
Yeah. In terms
I'm
of
going to use, he's going to use the 4-day, the county season, that he, the 5 matches that he played in county cricket, to give him momentum for T20 cricket.
Yeah. How do they get the balance right with these 3 T20s against South Africa? Because you mentioned there about Shamar Joseph. So Shamar Joseph has played one game in the IPL. So he's played one game since January. You then go into your first 2 games that you're saying there in the World Cup are in Guyana. So you're probably not, he's probably not going to play in them too. And then how do you get the balance of a side for three games when you've got such a different.
Well, let's look at it. 9 guys in the IPL. I don't know how many are coming home because the franchise is now, it's coming down to that crunch time of playoffs.
Yeah.
Right. So you have 9 guys in the IPL. Some will be coming back to the region. The head coach said that those guys who are coming back to the region will feature in the series against South Africa and Jamaica. So whoever is coming back from the IPL will be featuring in the series against South Africa. So that will be a gauge. So if Shamar Joseph, a franchise, don't make it to the playoffs, obviously he will be looking to play against South Africa and Jamaica.
Yeah.
So those 3 T20s against South Africa will be like trial matches for those guys who did not play the IPL to show the West Indies selectors that they are informed. Because Sherfin Rutherford is at KKR. They're in the playoffs. I don't think he's going to come back to prepare for a World Cup. He's going to seal that franchise to the IPL finishes. So you got guys like Romario Shepherd, who's at Mumbai Indians. He'll be coming back. So hopefully he'll go to Jamaica and he'll want to make amends for not playing enough IPL cricket.
Yeah.
Almeers have not played a game in the IPL. So I believe that he should be included in the squad against South Africa as well to give him a run out because you just can't dump him and forget him. I think that he still can feature in our T20 World Cup. I think our T20 cricket. Then you have to look at a captain. No, Ralph Mopola, I don't think he's going to be there. Alzari Joseph is the vice captain of the World Cup squad. If he returns, but he captained the side against South Africa, you're going to give it to Ross and TSU captain the side in Nepal.
But I've been hearing talks about Evan Lewis potentially being called up to Jamaica as well to play against South Africa, which I found baffling because Evan hasn't played cricket for anyone for quite some time now. Hasn't really made any big runs or anything. So like, how can you just throw away Kyle Mayers but then call up Evan Lewis?
I don't know that. I if that happens, it's going to be vintage in the Caribbean because Evan Lewis refused to go on tours. When asked if he's available, he said no. Kyle Mears is still a young man. He hasn't played cricket, but he was involved in the IPL, so he had to be practicing and training. So why would you tell Evan Lewis come and go to Jamaica to play against South Africa? What vision do you have for Evan Lewis down the road? The T20 World Cup is not the end of T20 cricket. There's still more international T20 internationals to play. Yeah. England are going to be in the Caribbean in the winter. So they're playing some T20 matches. You're going to tell me that you're going to roll back into Evan Lewis, who doesn't show that commitment. And there's always some injury scare and some in this and the next and the that and the problem of unavailability. If that happens, I'd be surprised. Yeah. I think that Kyle Mears can slot into our T20 squad, although he's not in the World Cup, in that squad against South Africa, he can slot in. He can get the opportunity to showcase what he can do. And the selectors will also give him the confidence to say, look, we still have belief and confidence in you, although you didn't make the World Cup squad. But we believe that you can still help us in our international T20 cricket. He's still a young man. He's not that old a man, so he's still young enough to help West Indies cricket. I think he should be given the opportunity. So if Evan Lewis gets ahead of him, I'll be surprised.
I just want to, obviously you two have been talking there about, you know, who's playing and different bits and pieces like that. Rewind about 40 minutes ago, you were saying about the change in terms of, how the dynamic of West Indies cricket sort of changed and it sort of got a bit more timid. Do you think this has come from the powers that be above, where they've not had that structure and that sort of constant strategy, that everything just is all over the place all the time? So there just doesn't seem to be any structure there.
Yeah, we lack a structure. Years ago, we lacked the structure. But where we benefited is from the experience. Because when I played with Desmond Hayes and Gordon Grange, there was a big structure. Barbados cricket was strong, but those guys lent support that was needed to develop the cricketers. No, I blame a lot on the territorial boards, because I believe the territorial boards in the region, they don't function properly. Because if you're a territorial board, to me, you have to have programs in place from the junior cricket to develop your cricketers across the various age groups. And we have to include women as well in this. So there have to be developmental programs from junior level to come up to the first class franchise level, and then to the West Indies A team level, then to senior team. So it has to be a seamless development process. We had a seamless development process because we had the experienced players who played West Indies cricket playing with us. And we used to listen. And we used to stay in the dressing rooms and listen to those guys talk cricket. We got an understanding of what is required at the international level.
Yeah.
Now you don't have that kind of discussion. Kieran said it earlier. The guys will play the game and they get off the... I don't want to take the shower, but they want to get their cell phones and move.
Yeah.
And you don't know why they want to go so quickly, because at the end of the day, you need to discuss what happened at the day's play. I can remember Desmond Haynes once said to us, gentlemen, at the end of every day's play, each man, including the 12th and 13th man, will go in the mirror and stand up and say, did I put 110% into there? And that is what it's about. But then 110%, because that is the only way that you can move your game to the next level. You can't move your game to the next level by 50%. And that is what some of our modern day players are doing. They're moving the game only 40 or 50%, maybe 60 at the most, but they want to have the performances of a man like Virat Kohli, who's put in 140%. And he made it early in his mind that he wants to be the best batter, and then he charted a path to how to become the best batter. And fitness was at the key. So we had those setups because we had experience. Now the experience don't talk, or the experience is gone, or the experience is disrespected in some instances. So that development does not happen at the rate at which it should be happening in the Caribbean. So the players in the Caribbean are taking longer to develop. And I can use an example. You take a young side to Australia, and they won a test match at Adelaide, first test match we won in 27 years. And if you look at some of those young guys who came back to the region to play a four-day cricket, how many of them scored hundreds?
Yeah.
Because they fall back into a first-class franchise in the region with guys who are just 40% into putting in the effort.
Yeah.
So they've come off a maximum effort in Australia, and instead of maintaining it, they fall into bad habits and guys who just barely throw in the line.
Yeah.
And that is the key. If you're going to, if you want to be successful, you have to put in the work at all levels. So it becomes easier, because the higher you go, it gets harder, but it can be easier because you've laid the groundwork. Yeah. And the groundwork is not being laid in the Caribbean.
Yeah. Well, can't disagree with everything you just said there, to be fair. I think you've absolutely hit, you've hit the nail on the head with it all. Extremely passionate.
Yeah, but cricket is my life. Yeah. Although I study law, cricket is my life, because I still watch cricket, I still study cricket, and I look at cricket around the world, and you can see the trends. When the IPL first started, it was all West Indians they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Now the IPL is going on, look at the nationalities. I don't want to call them, but look at the nationalities. They're varying now. And you're getting some nationalities there that don't speak Hindi. Because the people are pulling from the nationality, the players from the other countries who are putting in 115%.
Yeah.
And that's why they're getting the success. So you have to put in the work. All players used to put in the work, but they've become lazy and rest on their laurels because they believe muscle is it. But all if not muscle, there's something called memory and skills. Then you can apply muscle and be successful.
Well, wow.
I'm sorry.
No, honestly, thank you so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I know I can't thank you enough, you know, for going and talking about it, and you know, you've given me anyway massively, you know, this insight in terms of like the you know, the, how you were brought up playing the game and the infrastructure in place and your passion towards where it came from and things, and ultimately at the end of the day, I can sense that, you know, the change in it all and how you just want that, you know, that West Indies, I don't know how to describe it, but that sort of tradition to sort of come back and really sort of, you know, be allowed to flourish a little bit, really.
Yeah, West Indies need to get the passion, the killer instinct, but smile.
Yeah, three key things.
Passion, killer instinct, and smile.
No.
And then everything else is going to happen.
Well, you can
probably... Once we have the passion, the killer instinct, and smile, we're going to win.
Yeah.
And when you win, everything happens for you. You don't need to worry.
No. Well, spot on. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been absolutely fantastic. And I really appreciate you taking your time out of your night to come and join us. So thank you. And I'd love to get you back on after the World Cup or even during the World Cup to see and give us your feedback and your thoughts on that. So hopefully we'll catch up soon.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure, man. All the very best.
Much appreciated.
Take care. Okay, take care, gentlemen. Cool.
All right.
Thank you for joining us on the Power Play podcast, hosted by Kyron Powell and Jordan Shannon. We hope you enjoyed this immersive dive into the world of cricket and business, exploring the unique experiences and perspectives of players past and present, alongside those invaluable insights into intriguing business themes that transcend beyond the boundaries of sporting heroics. Be sure to set your reminders on your Alexa or Google Home device. Or we won't tell anyone if you still use those paper calendar things from a bygone era. Join us next time for more inspiring dialogue with scintillating minds on the Power Play podcast.